The 100 Years' War, the De Guesclin period, the war in Flanders, 1382-1383, part 2. Well, with the collapse of the government of Louis de Mal in Flanders, occurred at a really good time because the English Parliament was getting ready to assemble at Westminster. It opened up a strategic opportunity barely dreamed of when Philip van der Aart's emissaries had been in England. Yet it also provoked a bitter debate, which was to continue on in one form or another for the next 3 years. Between those who wanted to grasp the opportunity of intervening in Flanders and those associated with John of Gaunt, who were determined that any English army available for service overseas should be used to shore up the position of the Earl of Cambridge in Portugal. The Portuguese Chancellor, Lourenco Folga, an engaging diplomat and a firm Anglophile, had recently arrived in England to add his own voice to the clamor for southern strategy. He was once again described by his master as a man with the cross of St. George graven on his heart. When Richard Scrope stood up on May the 8th, 1382, to deliver the traditional address, he told the assembly of the plan to send the young king abroad with an army of 6,000 men, but he was no more precise as to the army's destination than to say France. This must have added to the suspicion of an assembly which had learned to distrust the government's military enterprises and had already washed its hands the Duke of Lancaster's Castilian ambitions. In the event, it did not matter. The Commons was unwilling to contemplate a grant of war taxation at all except for purely defensive purposes. The discussion turned mainly to a plan to borrow £60,000 on the security of a parliamentary guarantee, a variant of the scheme which Parliament had already rejected when John of Gaunt proposed it in February. It was a difficult time at which to borrow money, let alone a large sum. The knights invited the lords to appoint a commission of merchants to advise them. 14 merchants were nominated, half of them Londoners, included John Philpot, the former mayor who had been involved in a number of previous royal loans, and the rich grocer Nicholas Brembry. They were more pessimistic than the financiers, who had considered the question in March. They declared that the money could not be raised even with a parliamentary guarantee. It reminded the Commons of the fate of the bankers who had bailed out the government in previous crises. Pole, Westingham, Walwayne, all these princely merchants of the last generation had been rewarded with persecution and bankruptcy. The most that their successors would do was guarantee the repayment of such loans as the parliamentary peers and knights might care to make out of their own pockets. The peers and knights did not take the hint, and projected loan was abandoned. The government tried to find money by other methods. They raised a modest loan from London, the London branch of a Genoese banking house. They offered discounts to exporters for paying the wool tax in advance. They sold off more of Richard II's jewels. Even with these expedients, the English government's total receipts at the six-month period from April to September came to less than £22,000, one of the lowest figures for any corresponding period since the 1330s. By the time Parliament was dissolved on May the 22nd, 1382, it was clear that no offensive operations would be possible for months. The council appointed three representatives to report the disappointing outcome to the leaders of the rebellion in Flanders. They left at the end of the month. As for Fogacha, he remained in England, buying horses and weaponry in London, and confecting plans with John of Gaunt to send a second army to Castile in the following year, if not in this one. Balked in the direction of England, Philip van Artevelde offered an olive branch to the government of France. He wrote a mild and friendly letter to Charles VI, inviting him to order the Count of Flanders to return to his domains and govern them in justice. Failing that, van der Artevelde proposed that the French king should take the country into his own hands and appoint a royal governor. The French king's counselors laughed at his impertinence when the letter was read to them, and the messenger who delivered it was thrown in the prison. Yet van Artevelde's assumption that the French government might help him was by no means absurd. Louis de Mal had a firm ally in his son-in-law, Philip of Burgundy, who had promised him the support soon after his withdrawal to France. But in spite of his dominant position at the king's council, there was a heavy weight of consensus against him. Louis de Mal had never been a popular figure at the French court. There were still plenty of influential noblemen who found a certain satisfaction in his misfortunes. They were strongly opposed to allowing France to become involved in a ferocious and apparently endless civil war against rich and populous towns which had shown themselves to be resourceful antagonists. Some of these men also took the view, for which there was much to be said, that Louis's intransigence towards Ghent had contributed largely to his problems, and that France could play a more productive role by brokering a settlement. French ministers were, of course, aware of the English government's intrigue with Van Artevelde in March, for the Count must surely have told them. But at this stage, they took the threat to the English intervention very lightly. They had no doubt learned about the debates in Parliament by May. The forthcoming peace conference was the main focus of attention. After successive postponements, it was now due to open on June the 20th. John of Gaunt still expected to attend, and the Duke of Burgundy had been nominated as the head of the French delegation. No one seems to have been very sanguine about the prospects of a permanent peace, but great hopes were invested in the fallback proposals for a 12-year truce, which had been one of the ideas discussed during the preliminaries in March. This had obvious intentions of the French. It would indefinitely defer the thorny issues which had frustrated previous conferences. It would make it unnecessary for them to surrender territory as the price of peace, and it would leave the English king with no more than the insignificant ribbon of land that he still held in the southwest. Some thought was given to what would happen if the conference failed, but the current French military planning didn't contemplate a campaign in Flanders. The government had resolved as long ago as April in 1381 that the king would lead an army into the south as soon as the money could be found to pay for it. Their main priorities were to suppress opposition to the Duke de Berry's authority amongst the city of the Languedoc, and to apply pressure on the English in the March of Gascony. This remained their position after the expulsion of Louis de Mauls from the Flemish regions of Flanders, and indeed throughout the summer of 1382. So we'll see what happens to this conference next time, and obviously the fighting is still going to continue. Now the sources for this: The Hundred Years' War, The Chronicles by Froissart, The Hundred Years' War by Perrois, The Hundred Years' War by Nylans, and The Hundred Years' War, The House Divided, Volume 3 by Sumption. So I hope you enjoyed that, and as always, don't forget to come by the website, summahistorica.com or historyaccordingtobob.com, and ask a question, leave a comment, check out our merchandise, and if you like what we're doing, please feel free to support us. Thank you very much.